At this point, everybody's heard of zero nymphing, and there's no mystery why, because it just catches fish. It's super effective. These techniques have been refined in the fly fishing competition scene, and it's one of those places that everybody sort of knows about it, but they know almost nothing about it. Things like how to sign up, where to even find the competitions, what are the rules, what do you do when you get there, yada, yada, yada. So my friend Bobby, also known as Trout Fries on YouTube, he recently competed in the Six Lakes Challenge in Utah. Obviously, he learned a ton from that experience, and there's a lot of things that I think a lot of you might want to know about if you were ever had it in the back of your mind where you wanted to compete in a fly fishing competition. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. Hey, Bob, thank you for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Awesome.
So I wanted to bring you back on the podcast because just recently you got to fish in a fly fishing competition, one of the Western Regionals, right? And I just wanted to talk to you about that because I think there's a lot of mystery about it, like what it's all about. I know people know about people like Lance and Devin and a few others out there, older guys like George Daniel, etc. I know there's a lot more guys on the team, but and ladies. And I think people just want to know, like, what do you do? How do you sign up? How do the points work? I mean, how hard is it to get on the team? Yada, yada, yada. So what did you just compete in?
So I competed in a Western Regional qualifier. This was held at Six Lakes Resort out here in Utah. It was a 12-person qualifier. And the way the qualifiers work is there's essentially a regional qualifier. Me and you, we would be in the Western region. And then you accumulate points over a series of 5 events. And you take those points and you go to the next step, which is called the interregionals. And you accumulate points there and fish a couple of those. And then if you're in the top 48, you qualify for the national championship. And you also accumulate points at the national championship. And you total all those points, and the top 15 make the national team. That's essentially how it works.
Awesome. So is this something that like anybody can just sort of sign up for and participate in?
Yeah, you pretty much all the qualifiers are posted on the website flycomps.com.
Okay.
And as long as you're fishing within your region for the most part, you can just sign up and fish any of these qualifiers.
Okay. I just in my little bit of looking around over the last few months, it seems like the field, the number of people that can sign up is somewhat limited. Is there a lot of demand or is it depend on which event? Like I get the feeling like once they open up registration, you kind of got to get in there and get a seat. Is that the case?
Sometimes it is. It depends kind of how long the notice has been given. If it's last minute, sometimes they're struggling to fill it with people, but it's been up a while and people have been able to plan travel and time off and all that. Yeah, you probably want to be clicking on the register button right when it opens up.
Well, that's cool. I think it's neat that pretty much anybody, at least at the lower regional levels, can sign up and see what it's all about, because I think it seems kind of intimidating. It's, you know, a lot of people don't like the competition scene, I think, because it sort of steals some of the joy of what fishing is for them. It's a chill kind of escape from the world, and that's kind of stressful in some ways. What do you think it's like to prepare for an event like this? Because it's in some ways, it's more than just being a good angler, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like the line Lance uses when he talks about, because there is a lot of mixed opinion on, you know, whether competitions are so-called good for fly fishing or whether, you know, it does, like you said, take the joy out of it. But the line Lance always uses is it's just people that like to go out and fish, and you just happen to take really good notes of the fish you catch. And that's essentially what it is.
I like that. I think a lot of people, there's kind of this, I don't know what you call it, just sort of a mentality of the counting fish is bad. But I think everybody also, on the other hand, wants to become better anglers. And the primary metric for determining whether you're improving as an angler is catching more fish, getting more in the net. So if you're, you know, making a big deal about not counting and then you still want to get better, it seems a little bit of irony there. But that aside, getting, you know, prepared for a fly comp, there's a lot more than just, like you said, making good decisions on the water with fly choice or presentation or tactics. There's a lot about time management. We've talked about this off camera before we recorded, but Tell us what that's like to sort of have to make decisions in a time crunch.
Yeah, so there's a lot of prep that can go into it. Like, you want to have a good idea of, one, how you want to fish. Obviously, it's helpful to pre-fish. I didn't happen to be able to pre-fish for this one, but I was familiar with the lake, so I had somewhat of a game plan going in. But, I mean, the way these are set up, we're on a small lake. We're going to fish for 3 hours and rotate throughout. So your decision-making in real time, like, has a big role in how successful you do. You got to know when something's not working or the fish aren't reacting well. You got to change up and figure it out really fast. You can't spend, you know, half your time trying to figure out and then make up fish. If you get behind, you're going to be, it's really tough to play catch up.
And just small mistakes sort of multiply, right? Like, even just tangling or breaking off a fish, as you did in this one of these days, retying, I mean, that's valuable time, right? And that affects you mentally.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I feel is going to come with experience, but I definitely struggled with it in this event. The first time I fished one of these, I actually fished pretty clean. So I kind of felt like I was doing okay on that front. And then, of course, you know, everything kind of catches up to you at some point if you think you've got it. Let's see, I broke off on two fish and that completely blew up rigs. I had two roll in the net that made me retie rigs. And, you know, each time you retie, yeah, you can do it fast, but it's 3-5 minutes on a 3-fly, 20-foot leader rig that you got to retie. And that's all time your flies aren't in the water and you're not catching fish. And everyone that is fishing is putting numbers that you're not. So that was definitely something that was painfully obvious to me, is that I need to clean up a lot of that stuff. And a lot of the good guys, it's, you can really tell how efficient they are, because they're just, the rig changes are fast, their flies are in the water all the time. They're not messing with like line getting caught in bushes and, you know, untangling rods on the bank as you switch them out.
I think that this format being a bank fish to lake is probably different than a river comp, because each beat on a river is, you know, 100-150 yards of river per se, where these are segments of a bank, so you can sort of just look down the bank and see how your competitors are doing. And I assume that's a little more difficult psychologically. Or, I mean, can you see them when they're making mistakes or catching fish or hooting and hollering success?
You can. They're 20 yards away from you, right? So, I mean, you can even see how they're fishing too. That's a pretty big, interesting part of like the still waters, especially when you're all fishing around each other. You know, if you're pulling flies, you can tell someone's pulling flies, or if you're fishing static with a dry dropper, you can just see someone sitting there with the rod in their hand watching a, you know, a dry fly waiting for it to go under. So in these, especially in these bank competitions where you can see how everybody else is fishing, these aren't big lakes, you know, at most you're 80 yards away from the other person, like the farthest person. So definitely watching how people are catching fish is an important, you know, change you got to make, or it's something you need to be aware of. So like the first lake I fished, I drew a group with Devin, Nick, whose last name I'm not going to try and pronounce, but he's one of the top guys in the West.
Okay.
And another guy, Harry. That first session, it was our first session of day one, and Devin caught a fish right away pulling flies. That's one thing I've noticed about Devin that he was really good at when I could watch him fish, is he was really good at getting those one or two fresh fish that haven't been fished to just to eat right away. And no one else really capitalized on that. So, you know, it's almost like starting a fish or two ahead.
Do you have any idea of what he was doing to do that? I mean, I would assume everyone's getting their flies in the water right away. What is he doing differently?
I noticed he was pulling like what I assume was a triple fly rig and just getting that, those first reaction fish to eat the flies right away. One of the things about these comps is, one, you're just casting in the same area over and over and over again. So the fish that are, you know, cruising in and out see your flies in your rig, and they get used to fly line hitting the water in the same spot over and over again. So it's amazing how many fish will rise right beyond your casting range when you're fishing these. before those fish get used to seeing all the lines going in the water, Devin's really good at getting those first few fish to eat. Just pulling a triple fly rig, getting those reaction strikes right away.
Gotcha. So that particular tactic might be something that fresher fish are more likely to react to, where fish that have been cast over for half an hour would be a little less into. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. So for that first session, I ended up in a tie for first with Devin and Nick in that session.
Right on.
But I didn't catch any fish in my first beat. And I think Devin caught one and Nick caught one. So it was not fast fishing. These lakes are never fast fishing, really.
Okay.
Since there's not a big fish population, they're all managed for big fish. So they're not dumping 1,000 10 to 12 inch fish in these lakes. One thing I noticed is that pulling flies after Devin caught this first one was just not going to work. And I had a beat that I could see all the way into. It was about 8 feet deep with weed beds. And I could just see the fish cruising the same lane back and forth. And I threw my pulling rig in front of them and they wanted nothing to do with it. Right. So I picked up on the need to just fish something. I fished a really small chironomid underneath my dry fly and just sat it right in those lanes. And in that second beat, I was able to get two fish on dry dropper, which actually put me in the lead.
Wow. At that point okay. in time. Nice.
And I was literally watching the fish cruise back and forth. I'd cast 30 feet, 20, 30 feet in front of it and just let it sit there. And they'd see it and just kind of be interested. And I'd just move it a little bit, wait 5 seconds, dry fly would go under.
Just a little bit of action there.
Yeah. Yeah. But small chironomid, they weren't going to eat anything. At least in that first lake, they weren't going to eat anything like flashy or big. There were small chironomids coming off and that's all they wanted to eat.
And I bet, you know, just sitting there when you've got Devin and you said it was Nick was the first session, right? I guess it doesn't matter. I mean, these are all top anglers and, you know, you're seeing them reel in fish or whatever happens. Like, I bet in your mind, you magnify your own mistakes and then you're also magnifying their successes or you're perceiving what they're doing in such a way that it just seems like it would be such a psychological battle to stay cool and calm and just trust in what you know how to do and make decisions. Did you wrestle with any of those kind of things? I mean, did you have to get out of your head a few times or how did that even play out?
Well, for the most part, at least in three of the four sessions, I felt like I got a good feel for what the fish were doing. And everyone kind of ends up fishing the same way because they're all, like you said, they're all exceptional anglers and experienced and they can all figure out what the fish are doing too.
Right.
So it's just a matter of like executing on the eats you do get. The problem solving is the big important part of it. You know, you've got such a limited time to fish for these fish and like figure out what they're doing. So you got to be able to trust your gut. As soon as like something feels like it's not working, you got to go find and figure out something that's going to work. You can't just wait for the fishing to turn on or get lucky one's going to eat your rig. You got to actively go out and seek out the best technique, depth, retrieval rate, all that stuff that's going to get you the most chances at catching a fish.
Just thinking about that makes sense. But didn't the winner of like a 3-hour session get 5, maybe 6 fish total? So, I mean, that's a fish every 20, 30 minutes. It seems hard to draw any patterns from that kind of a catch rate, unless you go through a period of not catching and then suddenly you figure it out and then you start catching more sequentially. Is that kind of how it played out?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. A lot of the sessions were won with 4, 5, 6 fish. And when you think about it like that, it makes you realize, oh, I need to catch, you know, a fish an hour and 2 fish an hour in one of the beats or something like that, right? To be successful.
Which isn't a lot. It's not many.
Yeah. So it gives you, at least it lets you feel like you're not falling behind and you just feel like as long as you're doing the right thing and you'll get the eats at the rate you need to win these things. But whether you execute on them is a different thing.
Right. But I mean, you may not drop back as far, but any small mistake would get magnified. I mean, if you break off a fish, I mean, that fish could be the difference between first and fourth place. I mean, that's kind of a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's interesting, especially about these specific Stillwater events, is that there's good beats and bad beats too. Like, each lake had some shallow weed bed beats on the edges of the we were pretty much fishing off the dams for the most part.
Okay.
So like the corner beats, you know, had shallow weed beds, fish were moving in and out feeding. So you had a chance probably to intercept more fish that were interested in eating. But the middle beats are just like chunk rock, deep, you know, kind of featureless beats. So in a way, sometimes, you know, they're deep and sometimes they're up shallow, but you need to figure out kind of where they are and maximize your time when you're fishing the good water. When I started out on the deep beats, I didn't think that was going to be the best ones just because, you know, featureless chunk rock, like gradient stuff isn't really like, you know, your good still water holding areas necessarily. So I knew if like I started out on those, one, that kind of sucks because you're not going to get the first crack at the, you know, cruising fish looking for food, really.
Right.
But if I get a little behind, I feel like, you know, you can make it up once you get on the better beats.
Okay.
And sometimes that's the case.
In this particular event, it wasn't completely full, so it kind of worked out so that each angler fished all three beats, right, in each session?
Yeah.
Because that might not be the case if there's more people, right?
Yeah, in a way, that's like an absolutely fair way, you know, or as fair as it can be. Obviously, you're fishing at like different times and that does matter. But say there's like six people in three sessions, at least you're still alternating and you're kind of, you either fish the odds or the evens, but they're all next to each other. So it's still fairly fair, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I was thinking if there were six beats and you only got to fish three of them, potentially you could get screwed a little more than if you had to do all of the beats that everyone's fishing. That makes sense.
Yeah, you can. I mean, they try and make it fair. It's not like if you get the odd beat, you're going to be screwed or anything like that. Like, you know, if there's six in a row and in a line, maybe you'll fish, you know, 1, 3, and 5 or 2, 4, and 6. And you'll at least get some that are, you know, the order feeding fish beats and some that are the deep featureless ones. But
I remember when I talked to you after the first time you did one of these competitions at the same venue, you mentioned that casting skill made a big difference and that some of the other people near you may have struggled or couldn't cast as far, so that made a big difference. But I didn't hear you talk about that this time. Was it a higher caliber of competitors, or can you talk about that kind of thing?
Yes, it was this time.
Okay.
The field this time, while it was smaller, was the best guys in the West, and Madoker, who's she was on the lady fly fisher, the women's fly fishing team, and she's did well enough in the last round of the, you know, it's not the men's team, but you know, the main national team. She qualified for the main team.
Right on.
I got to fish with her the second day. She's an amazing fly fisherman. I was
cool.
Super impressed. But everyone there this time could cast well, so I didn't feel like, if anything, my casting didn't give me an advantage this time. And that's one of the things that I noticed between this one and the last one, is that I feel like I needed a better rod quiver and like it's a little bit better gear to pull from. So
like
that's definitely something going.
Because what did your gear hold you back on?
So I brought 2 10-foot 5-weights and my 9-foot 5-weight ultralight. I had a pair of 7-weights with me too, but I don't love those rods, so I didn't really feel like I wanted to bring them out. And I didn't have a good suite of 7-weight lines that I was comfortable with.
Okay.
So the lines are something I need to add to, but honestly, my 10-foot 5-weights when like wind came up was a little bit of a disadvantage. And I've already added a new 10-foot 7-weight to my rod quiver, and I'm going to add a 10-foot 6-weight. I think they're just important for turning over those triple fly rigs into the wind.
what kind of casting range were you working at?
You know, we're probably casting 70, 80, 90 feet.
Okay. So big casts.
Yeah. Like, you're hero casting, though. You're pretty much hero casting for 3 hour sessions in a row.
Wow. But that's impressive.
But like I said, you know, there's a lot of times those fish know how far you're casting. And if you can touch 5-10 feet farther than the person that's fishing before, you've got an advantage. So.
Well, and it also seemed like there were a couple times, I should mention, if anybody hasn't seen him yet, he's got 2-part video series where he basically recorded a GoPro. And you could see all this that we're talking about. But there was a moment when you had one of the edge beats where you had like a corner that you couldn't cast into. So I kind of got the vibe that it was like this sort of narrow corridor. So you couldn't really fish left and right so much as you had to go out away from the bank if you wanted to cover new water. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So the way that beat flags work is that you have to fish 90 degrees from the way the flags are lined up. So you can't cross over that, you know, say invisible line 90 feet out. They oftentimes cut off those corners or like the cuts, especially if there's a beat that faces 90 degrees that like wraps around. You'd be casting in the same water if they intersected like that. So you need to kind of space it out, which means a lot of times the corners of the lakes get cut off, which is, you know, where a lot of the fish are sometimes.
Right. Interesting.
But specifically for that, I at least know there's fish moving in and out of that corner. So I was fishing right along the boundary, hoping to intercept the fish that were moving in and out of that spot.
Okay.
It made me think I could refresh some of those fish and it'd just be a higher, you know, population, the fish I'd be fishing for.
That makes sense.
And that panned out to an extent.
You just kind of worked that edge, hoping they would come in and out of your beat.
Yeah, just, you know, threw a dry dropper right on the boundary and hoped to intercept those fish, just fishing static.
You mentioned that having to fish static after, you know, the initial moments of the starting time, just because the fish got weary or whatever might have changed, but trying to make a decision about that being the right rig when sometimes when you got to let it sit there for minutes on end before a fish reacts to it, how do you know like how long to let a static rig sit idle before you either recast or decide to switch to something else?
I mean, that's not that different than say fishing a moving rig and varying up your retrieve rate. Just a matter of like whether you think they just need it absolutely still. They're going to look at it probably for, you know, 10, 20 seconds, debate whether to eat it, and then they'll eat it. Or if you could add a little movement to try and trigger their decision to eat it or try and get some attention to it. It's just kind of a feeling out process. When there's so few fish caught, it's kind of an indicator that you need to fish pretty slow versus
to point
creating a lot of like attention to your rig. So a lot of what informed my decision on how often I recast it or whether I was going to move it was the catch rates among the group. The harder it seemed like the fishing was going to be, the slower you want to go, no matter what rig you're fishing.
That's a good nugget right there. I think one of the things about these fly fishing competitions, if you want to get involved in it, is you need to be well-rounded, because I think a lot of people are into Euro nymphing and fishing moving waters, but I feel like probably a majority of anglers fishing still water is a big hole in their skill set. So kudos to you for spending so much time in a float tube or just working all your local lakes. But is that a good assessment? Just you need to be well-rounded. You can't just be a dry fly guy or a streamer guy. You got to know how to do everything. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that's true for all the comps, but for nationals, for worlds, you know, there's usually at least one or two stillwater beats or stillwater sessions in them. So traditionally, one of the weaknesses of the U.S. team is that we don't have a lot of strong stillwater guys as compared to like Europe or like, you know, the U.K. where they spend most of their time on stillwaters versus moving water.
Right, just out of availability.
Yeah, but it seems like some of those UK style still water techniques are coming over to the US somewhat slowly, but they're making their way here. Things like, you know, Mitch tips, washing lines, stuff like that.
Right. Yep. I've been, there's a guy in my Discord who just came over who's from the UK, and we've all been just having an education, learning from him. It's like a completely different language, a different vocabulary. And it's really cool to learn and see how people have figured things out.
So water fishing's fun. Really, you know, rivers are fun, urine and things fun, doing all that stuff, but the water's got some nice fish in them. Yeah. Fun way to fish. Feels a little more active. You can kind of just search out, move some flies, you know?
I think a lot of people they know that that lakes hold bigger fish in general, and just because there's just so much more biomass for them to consume. But they walk up to the bank and they're just like, what do I do? I mean, in a river, you could see the seams and the structure more clearly. Do you have any advice on just sort of how to approach a lake or getting started?
I guess one of the benefits of having a background in bass fishing is understanding how fish relate to things like structure and cover in lakes. And bass are a little bit more, they relate to stuff a little bit better than trout do, but trout still like cruise things like wave lines and just small microcurrents in the water matter for, you know, just getting stuff moving around for them to eat. And, you know, they relate to depth and stuff in the water column too. So it's, what's nice about lakes is they're pretty easy to pattern once you figure stuff out. So like rivers, you know, it's all a process of elimination type of thing. You want to figure out, eliminate water, eliminate flies, eliminate certain techniques until you kind of narrow it down to what they're doing that day. It's not that different from moving waters, I guess, in that sense, you know.
Sure.
You just have to cycle through stuff and you'll eventually find the right technique.
Yeah, and do you feel like bank fishing has just as many opportunities as, say, a float tube would, or is it just depend on the lake?
I mean, a lot of it depends on the time of the year, how good access you get wherever you're bank fishing. Whether, you know, if it's like a 3 foot deep flat and you're not going to find a ledge until you're, you know, a couple hundred yards off the bank, then yeah, bank fishing is going to be a little bit tough. I mean, a lot of people, you know, hike into high mountain lakes, do some bank fishing.
Sure.
Not much different than that.
Yeah, for sure. I think it just, people need to sort of, you know, be willing to basically start over again. I think a lot of people have confidence on rivers and they don't want to start over again and learn something new. So there's a lot of hesitation. I feel that in myself, at least. Maybe I'm projecting, but I think I've had success on lakes. I just don't always think to go there and explore them more. So I think there's opportunities there for people to learn and catch bigger fish using new techniques. I think it's something we should all explore more.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I understand how lakes can be daunting. There's a lot of water. A lot of it looks the same, but if you take some of the same principles of moving water, fly fishing, find an area that's got food, you know, figure out if trout need food and safety. So anytime they can feed and, you know, have a good place to escape to, not much different from rivers. As long as you find all the right variables within the body of water, you're going to find fish.
Well, to bring this back to competing, is this particular event kind of unique in that it was just bank fishing on still water? Aren't most of them sort of a combination of different types of water?
Yeah. So it could be one of three things. You could be river fishing, which is wade fishing. It could be a bank event where you're on the bank, not wading into the water, essentially. Or it could be a lock style event where you're paired in a boat, you know, usually using a drogue to make drifts and fish out of a boat.
And for those that don't know, what is a drogue?
Drogue's pretty much like an underwater parachute that slows your drift down.
Okay.
When the wind's pushing you a certain direction, it just works as like to slow down your velocity so you can fish at a good rate. But It allows you to cover water during a drift.
As opposed to being anchored up.
Yeah. What's nice about lock-style fishing, I try and do a little bit in the tube. I don't have a watercraft myself other than the tube.
Okay.
But you can kind of, you're always fishing to new fish because you're fishing in front of you in the direction you're fishing.
But the, like a typical event structure will have all of these components over different sessions, right? It's not just one or the other. Or is it all the things?
Say a world, you'll probably fish three river sessions and two still water sessions.
Okay.
Sometimes it could be four and one or something like that. But yeah, you need to be well-rounded in all the type of water you can fish.
And I kind of asked you about this before, but what is a typical way for you to prepare? You mentioned most people will pre-fish. Is that enough? I mean, is it a matter of just figuring? I mean, it seems like lakes, and you're going to be wanting to know. Well, I don't know. It's those kind of situations. You kind of have to read them in the moment. But maybe a river, you want to know what the, if there's a lot of slicks or glides or pocket water, or does pre-fishing give you a big advantage?
Yeah, it would, because you kind of want to know, like, what bugs are coming off. You know, chironomids are around all the time, but, you know, they could be keyed in on calibatus, or, you know, there could not be a lot of bugs coming off, and they're going to be bait fish eaters, or they're going to be just eating leeches and scuds. Bait fishing will at least give you a good idea of what to start with. It'll give you a good, like, baseline point, and then if that's working, then you can stick with it. If it's not, you're at least and make the adjustments after that. Pre-fishing is also helpful just to know, are they going to be up shallow? Are they going to be deep? What's like the water depth they're going to be? Like how far are they cruising up top in the column? Or you need to throw the Type 7 on and, you know, get down there?
Yeah, I mean, these man-made lakes you were in were relatively small, so it didn't have a whole lot of depth to them. Is that right?
I mean, they got, you could cast out into 15, 20 feet deep.
But that's like a pond, in my opinion. It's not a huge lake.
Yeah, we're not fishing 30 feet deep, 100 yards offshore in these. So I brought my heavy lines, but I never caught a fish on anything deeper than a midge tip.
Interesting.
Even if I was letting the flies get down like 10 feet.
Yeah, maybe a water temp issue or just where the food's at.
Probably just where the food's at. I mean, it's late November out here in the middle of Utah, so water temps were low 40s.
Probably. Okay.
They're still warm enough that there's some chironomids coming off, but that was the only bug life. That's still pretty good temperature for trout.
Yeah, totally. I mean, those lakes are small enough, though. Do they, I forget what the term is, when they kind of flip where the
turnover.
The turnover.
Probably not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And just for people that don't know, there's like this moment when both the spring and fall where the thermal climb just sort of switches, right? Where the top of the lake gets colder, or I don't really understand it fully personally.
I think it's, let's see. I'm probably going to get this wrong and I shouldn't say it in front of people. But I think the cooler water comes to the surface during.
I'm not sure. Well, I imagine in the wintertime, the surface gets cooler. I mean, that's easier for me to visualize. So warm water rises. So maybe in the fall, the bottom, the warm water moves to the surface. I don't know.
I think what happens is the temperature that's more comfortable for the fish starts to move up.
Okay.
And brings them, the fish that have been, at least trout that have been down, you know, 30, 50 feet deep are now
in the warmer months
feeding on the surface.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's an easy way to think about where the fish are, is just the depth. Back to the preparing for these events kind of thing, a couple times you've made videos where you kind of simulated the time crunch, like give yourself an hour to fish 100 yards. Is that something you would recommend to someone who wants to get into this?
Yeah, definitely. Because one, it's good to get a good feel for how fast you fish through stuff. Because you obviously want to cover the best spots you can, but if you kind of have to time manage each like fishy spot to make sure you hit all the good ones and, you know, don't leave fish for the next guy. But a lot of what goes in, I like doing those because it makes me very aware of like how often I don't spend fishing and try and improve upon that.
Just like moving between spots or re-rigging or getting
Re-rigging, because you know, some spots fish, you want to fish a single fly rig in some spots. Some spots, you know, you might want to fish tri-dropper or go to a dual fly rig, and being able to cycle through those quickly to fish like the best possible technique and the best in specific water type is important. So,
well, I assume pre-fishing sort of helps get you dialed into what couple of techniques you might want to use, but still I think of like the systems of how you pack your bags makes a huge difference, or having the, you know, access to tippet that's not too tough, or et cetera, et cetera. Just being able to quickly change, or pre-rigged tippet sections with flies on it so you don't have to start over if you blow up a rig. All that kind of stuff seems like it would make a huge difference.
Yeah, it does. That's one of the things that I would never do or make sure I do in the future, is that to have a 3-fly rig long still water, a couple liters pre-tied that might even have flies on them that I can just unfurl and get going every time a rig gets blown up. I don't need to rebuild it. Because one thing I was doing is I was rebuilding my rig every time something happened to it.
Well, that's what, 3-4 minutes if you're fast?
Yeah.
Where it could be 30 seconds if you have one pre-rigged. Yeah, that makes sense. I do that every now and then for myself. And I'll sort of, when I'm unpacking at the end of the day, I'll realize, oh, I had all these foam rigs rolled set up and I never used them. But definitely it's fast when if you want to switch.
Yeah. And one of those times that it's standing out in my head that I really needed to have a system like that in place was in the third hour, so the last hour of our first session of day two. I was a few fish behind Madoka. She was at 5. Or going into the session, I was at 2. She was at 4. And I thought I needed to catch 4 fish to probably take first. And I was going into what I considered the best beat, so I thought I had a chance.
Okay.
And didn't catch anything for the first 30 minutes throwing my dry dropper rig, and I realized I needed to switch something up. So I went over to my midge tip and just started throwing a comp legal balance leech and a couple of chironomids over these weed beds. And second cast, I think doing that, hooked into a nice fish. The second cast after I caught that one, I broke off on a fish.
Oh, no.
Yeah. On 3X, too. I mean, these are super clear lakes, so like I was trying to balance, you know, how visible my line is versus these are big fish, so I needed to fish something pretty stout. Tip-wise.
Huh, right.
So 3X is kind of where I settled on for that kind of balancing act. But broke off my chironomid, top of the rig on 3X. And
dang, that's painful.
Yeah. And I mean, after I caught that first fish, I still felt like I needed 3. And losing, I had about 20 minutes left, losing 3 minutes there, re-rigging, getting everything back really hurt because I felt like I had back-to-back eats, so the fish were on. It was like a feed, you know, I hit a feeding period in the right spot. It's pretty rare to get a fish on, you know, almost back-to-back casts.
Right.
That whole event.
Yeah.
So, and then after I re-rigged the cast after that, caught my second fish for that session.
Wow.
Rolled in the net. Bird nested my rig.
Oh, no.
So I had to re-rig again. By the time I had, you know, gotten that fish recorded, released, re-rigged, I had about 6-7 minutes left. That was enough time to, I feel like I missed a little bit of the bite window re-rigging during that time, and I didn't leave myself enough time to catch at least the fish I needed to get a tie for first, or two fish I needed to take the session. So
right. So if you had had a couple rigged up tippet sections, I mean, you would have had what, 5-10 extra minutes of fishing.
Yep, which might have been the difference between a podium finish. One fish would have been the difference between a top 3 finish and not finishing in the top 3 that event. So stuff like that really matters.
Yeah. And I assume you're going to have to sort of integrate that into your day-to-day fishing. You got to have these kind of muscle memory in place. Otherwise, you won't go to it. Well, at least that's my personal experience with the foam rigs. I have a few, but I almost never use them. So I don't even think about it.
That's just one of those things. By fishing these, you really learn where your inefficiencies and the things that cost you time and fish really add up. And that's one of those things. Hopefully you only have to learn once. So
yeah, you don't want to make the same mistakes more than once, that's for sure. Going back to the time pressure sort of thing, are there restrictions on how many rods you can have? I know in lock style fishing, you can only have a single rod rigged at any given time, but I noticed in this you had several on the bank ready to go. Is that different for bank fishing and river fishing?
Yeah, for bank fishing, I think on average, the guys would have between 3 and 4 rods rigged. At some point, like having too many when you got to move around and stuff is too much. But like, I think Devin brought 4 rods out. I don't think there's a limit. The limitation is having to manage more than 4 rods.
Like what's efficient.
Yeah.
But I assume you can't have like a rod caddy to help you carry them around, or
other restrictions? You can. So that's one thing that the experienced comp guys that went there, imagine like a wall-mounted rod storage system,
okay,
just horizontal. Devin was carrying around one of those.
Interesting. What is it, like fishing roll on wheels? What does it look like?
It looks like...
like a little table?
No, it's like... it's tough to describe. You hold it in your hand, but it holds a rod horizontal and off the ground.
Okay.
So it's kind of like something for the rods to lean on.
Okay.
But you can carry, it can support like the butt end of the rod. And
you can grab them all together and they won't get tangled up, that kind of thing.
And move with them, yeah. For this event, that's super helpful because there's brush everywhere. So if you're not careful on where you're laying your rods around and you want to go pick one up and you happen to like get the line caught on like a branch, it's just... it's super annoyance, and you learn to just kind of keep them off that stuff at some point. But if you have a rod caddy, you don't even think about it.
That makes sense. I always find that when I have just a handful of rods, like usually it's 3 or more, they get stuck together, and typically gets stuck in places that it shouldn't be. So that rod caddy sounds like a good idea. But when I was saying caddy, though, I meant like a human to help carry your stuff. Is that allowed?
No, you're on your own.
Yep. Okay.
No.
Do they bring those for the rivers too? Because, I mean, going up and down the bank of a river seems much harder than down the bank of a lake.
No, I think most comp guys bring 2 rods with them. And there are guys that like to, you know, lean it against a tree, or guys that like to carry them, you know, inside their waders, you know, tucked in there, and just have the rod, like, you know, held in front of them as they're walking through the river. Personal preference on that stuff. I wouldn't want to be one of those guys that stuck a rod and had it dangling off of me while I was fishing. So I'm definitely leave it close by, but on the bank and like the guy.
Well, doesn't that play into how some of them are judged? In this particular event, you just took a photo of the fish in your net, but sometimes there is a judge that you have to return the fish to get it measured, or is that different scoring?
Yeah. So with these mini qualifiers, you know, when it's just us in the middle of nowhere, essentially, we can't have judges around to measure. Usually, you know, you measure the number of fish and the length. But when it's just us controlling each other and we're fishing at the same time, controlling means you're responsible for watching the other person, making sure they're catching the fish in a legal manner and adhering to all the rules and all that stuff. And your controller, if you're fishing like a river session, would also be the one that handles and measures your fish.
Okay.
But for these mini, you know, these small qualifiers, we don't, it's tough to get 12 controllers together for each angler. So you kind of control each other. So to make that process easier, we don't have to measure fish. We just have to record the number.
Okay. So this was just a sheer fish count. Big fish didn't matter.
Yeah. Once you start getting closer to nationals, that's when you start measuring and recording and in a more detailed manner.
is it like a choice where you only measure the big fish? I can never remember exactly how that's done.
There's a minimum size you need.
Okay.
I forget what it is.
Just to count it in general?
20 centimeters.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's still pretty small fish, maybe 6 inches, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's like seven something, I think.
Okay. But makes sense.
Yeah, most fish that will eat a fly will, for the most part.
So taking some of your pre-training, if you will, I mean, I think that's something that if you want to be successful at this, you kind of have to look at it differently than just picking the right fly. Like you said, optimizing your whole system for efficiency is like probably the piece that most people don't think about when they go fishing just for fun. What do you see for yourself going forward? Do you want to try to accumulate points for and see how far you can get with this?
Yeah, so I think I'm going to make a run at it. It may not be this cycle. This cycle I'm going to try and fish as many as I can. My kid's getting a little older, so I'm able to spend a little bit more time traveling, and hopefully it'll mean I can fish more of these. But I'm going to spend my time just getting comfortable with the whole process, working out some, finding out what I need to improve on, just in every aspect, like the efficiency stuff, and just learning as much as I can this cycle, and then really making a run at it in the cycle after. But I hope I can accumulate enough points to at least fish some of the interregionals and maybe squeak out a spot in the next nationals.
That would be cool. Do you consider that, I mean, a lot of the comps that are local to you, so they're in waters you're somewhat familiar with, do you think that'll make a difference if you were to travel to some unknown water?
Yeah, it would. So that's when I feel like I'm going to want to make sure I pre-fish to get a feel, because, you know, say we go over, like where nationals are in North Carolina, I've never fly fished in North Carolina. I want to get a feel for that.
I didn't even know there were trout there.
Yeah. It's actually pretty good fishing, right? All the guys at the comp, or most of them at least, had already qualified for this year's nationals. So they were all talking about it and pretty excited for the fishing
right
out there. It's probably going to be a pretty good numbers event. It'll be interesting to see if it's one of those, you know, events where the top finishers are going to catch 30, 40 fish in 2 hours, you know?
Wow. That'd be exciting to spectate.
And that's when, like, being familiar with the whole process really matters. Like, getting the fish in the net, getting it to the controller quick, getting them released quick and back fishing. That's something I want to get comfortable with going forward, too.
I think you shared a video with me from, I don't know which event, but I think it was in Europe somewhere. It was like a highlight reel. And I just remember this guy wading into absurdly fast water that was up to, you know, the top of his bibs, catching a fish, and he's literally running back to the bank. He got it measured, and then he's literally running back out, and it's just insane, like, amount of energy it's involved. And they really are athletic events. I mean, it's not like you're just casually fishing, and whoever happens to get the most, they're working for it.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, what's the culture like between all the anglers? Is there a lot of camaraderie, or is it kind of like tight-lipped, like, well, I figured out what worked, I'm not going to spill the beans, or is it they're all on the same team, so they're willing to sort of share?
That's actually one of the things I really liked, at least for the few Western ones I fished. All the comp guys are actually really friendly and cool.
Right on.
I think it's part of it's just like, you know, there's not a huge amount of people that do this, so, you know, it's a small group of people that do, and everyone knows each other, so everyone's kind of friendly with each other. And, you know, I was a new guy there, essentially, so, you know, they welcomed me in. It was a lot of fun being around these guys, and, you know, it's cool seeing, especially, like, some of the top anglers, you know, that you really have kind of an award to them, like,
sure,
being able to just hang out with Devin for, you know, as you're prepping gear and
right,
just, you know, talking to
bounce questions off
like
of
Devin Olson. Yeah, last time Lance was there, just, you know, it's a great way to, like, just take in as much information as you can. But I mean, sure, you don't really share your what's working during the middle of the event, but everyone's openly willing to talk about, you know, oh, yeah, I caught him this way at the end of it.
Oh, really? Like at dinner or something, you'll all sort of sit down and talk about it? Or
yeah. What's pretty funny, one funny story is, so the last session we fished on day two, my group fished Totem Lake, and that's the one lake on the whole complex that's managed for numbers. So instead of, you know, the session being won with 3 to 5 fish, Devin won the first session on that lake with 14.
Okay.
And second got 10. So, you know, we're talking triple the numbers of the other lakes.
Okay.
And Nick and I started off fishing next to each other. And that, I think that was that one session you were talking about where I couldn't fish in the corner, but I was talking about intercepting those fish right on the edge.
Okay. Yep.
And I started off fishing dry dropper there, and I caught 2, I think, within the first 10 minutes.
Nice.
And then Nick to my left, who ended up winning this session with 13, I got 9. He saw I got out ahead of him a little bit because I had caught a 3rd, but I think the time he told me he switched rigs because he thought I was fishing a certain way. And I saw him starting to catch fish. And once my techniques dried up, I switched to what I thought he was doing. So I thought he was pulling flies. And he, when he switched, I had started catching fish pulling flies, but he thought I was fishing dry dropper. So we had actually switched into what the other one wasn't doing, thinking we were switching into
That's hilarious.
What the other person was doing. And we both ended up catching fish on the way we switched. It's just a funny thing to talk about because it's like, oh, I thought you were fishing dry dropper the whole time, but I caught most of my fish pulling a midge tip. And I was like, I told him, I switched to the midge tip because I thought that's what he was catching his fish.
That's wild. Well, maybe just each section needed a new fresh technique. The fish there just wanted to see it differently. That's funny, though.
Yeah, so we had a good laugh about that.
Do you ever see or hear about people who might be fishing static, but they're motioning with their hands like they're doing a retrieve when they're not? Does that kind of stuff go on?
If it does, I don't know about it.
I'm just curious. It
seems would be funny. Yeah,
that seems like something you especially if
a bunch of slack in your line, but you're absolutely ripping the slack in, but the flies aren't moving.
Right. That'd be funny. Or if you are retrieving, you might indicate that you're doing a fast retrieve when you're actually only pulling every other movement or something. I imagine that goes on somewhere, sometime. Maybe when you get to the worlds or something.
Maybe that's a good question for Lance next time I go into fly fishing.
Yeah, I'd like to know. If you could ask it, since you have a lifeline, you could ask a pro. That's cool, though, that they're willing. It would personally be intimidating to me, even if I was a good enough angler. I don't know that I am. If I got in one of these events and they're over there, I'd be intimidating. I don't know how, if you just have done it enough now that, or you've talked to those guys just walking into fly fish food, that you're comfortable around them. But it seems, it's like the skill gap similar to, like, if I were to go throw a ball with, you know, somebody on the 49ers or something, it seems super intimidating.
Yeah, I mean, most of the guys all the guys that go to it, you know, they're all good fishermen and they all want to win. And I don't think people necessarily would stick with it if they didn't feel like they could compete. So I feel like everyone there is pretty confident in what they're doing.
Well, would you say the first time, the previous competition that where there were less skilled people, is it kind of humbling for some people? They go in there thinking, maybe I'm a guide and I know how to catch fish and I catch 80 fish a day on the lower Provo, so I'm a good angler. And then you get in there and get humbled. Does that kind of stuff happen too for green people?
Yeah, definitely. I can't speak for other people, but it's definitely a different thing, the competitions. Like, sure, anyone can go out and just smash fish on some river, but what if you're fishing behind Devin Olson in a beat, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, it's a different way of fishing because you're not always fishing fresh water, you know. you're time limited. These fish are generally going to be pretty beat up and aware that you're there. So it can be humbling in that way, in that you're probably not going to be able to replicate your average day on the water in these comps. But
that's a good point, because I think in general, we're trying to avoid crowded water. We'll put in the extra effort and hike far away. But when you say fish behind someone, like Devin will be on beat one the first hour, and then later you might be on that same beat the second hour. And so that's what you mean by being behind them. Like, he's already fished that water and hooked all the fish that want to eat. So this, you got to go and find the ones that want to eat again, or he missed. And that's going to be hard to do.
Yeah, it's a little bit, that matters a little bit more for the moving waters where the fish, you know, can't move in and out. The lakes are a little bit better where the fish will at least refresh a little bit and move in between beats. Yeah, on moving water, that's definitely a thing. I know people would be like, oh man, I got a fish behind Devin or Lance. Or, you know, you're at the Worlds, oh, I got a fish behind the Czech guy or the French guy.
How much does a single piece of water get fished per day? Is it three times?
For this competition, it would be six.
Well, but that's a lake. I mean, just like in a river, though, where you have, I guess that's where it's more important to have fresh water.
So in, like, say our local regional, they would get fished twice. So you'd generally get one fresh crack of fish, and then you'd fish behind somebody. But on the Worlds, you do fish 1.5 hours. You get the first crack at fish, and then you switch for the second hour and a half. But the river, so the fish don't move around that much. You could be on the fifth day, you know, it's been hit 4 days in a row before that. So if you look at the numbers at the Worlds, the first day on a certain beat or section is always usually the top number of fish caught, and it slowly goes down after that. But luckily, you're fishing against only the people that day.
Oh.
On your stretch of water, right? Oh. So it's fair for everybody, because everyone's fishing. You're just fishing against your group. So everyone's fishing beat up water. So it's a matter of how you do within your group, not against the whole field.
Okay. I did not realize that. That makes sense. Because, I mean, there's always some variability there. I mean, you can't make it perfectly fair, but that seems pretty close.
Yeah, so that's why the placing points matter. It's all that matters. It's how you do in your group on that day. And you get a certain number of placing points, and then each day adds up. So that's fair. I mean, it's as fair as you can get when you're all fishing, you know, the same water.
Well, and I know they tried to design the beats, at least on a river, where it's somewhat fair. Maybe a combination of slicks and pools and run and all that kind of stuff. At least I think they try. I've heard stories of the Worlds being a little unfair this year. Is that correct?
Lance and Devin can speak to that a little bit more, but I know a lot of the USA guys feel like they got pretty screwed on their beat draws.
Huh.
Because they weren't fair.
Huh. Just like the type of water was not very balanced between all the beats.
Like Lance was talking about a dry fly beat he got that he thinks the organizers were thinking it would be a dry flight chub beat. The chubs counted as the type of fish that would score in the Worlds in Slovakia. It was pretty much just shin deep, like weedy, shallow beat with no, like, you know, classic river pools or runs or anything like that. It's just like all riffly stuff. And he drew that beat when it had stormed the night before and completely blew out that beat. So you're not catching dry fly fish when the water's blown out.
No. Dang.
So, you know, people that could get down and get down to the fish that had good holding water that the fish had moved into did fine. But yeah. You get that type of draw, it's pretty demoralizing, I'm sure.
I can imagine. Especially when you've worked so hard to get there. Something else we've talked about is that, I mean, this is kind of a DIY sport. Like, to get to these levels and participate, you're kind of self-funding. There's no corporate sponsorships or anything or the country doesn't pay your way like they would at the Olympics or something. This is all self-funded, right?
I won't get into it, but there's some
oh
spiciness going on right now in the national team world.
Okay.
Yeah.
To swing it back, if somebody wanted to spectate, is that something that's allowed, or is it kind of like golf and you got to stand back and be quiet?
Well, I mean, it might depend on organizers. These, like, the regional qualifiers are kind of ad hoc in a way. Like, there's the Oregon guys kind of have their own set of pools and run their own qualifiers, and the Utah guys do the same. There's a couple guys in California that do it, but everyone's cool. I'm sure if you wanted to go watch or spectate, you could. It's just going to be driving out into the middle of nowhere, usually.
Sure. Well, that's fishing.
Yeah.
Well, I bring that up just because I think it just seems like this black box thing. I mean, everybody talks about it. I mean, we know about Lance and Devin for the most part. I know there's a lot more that participate at this high level, but we know about them because they share and they teach a lot online. But I think a lot of the negative opinions about the sport could be changed if people were more involved or even just knew more about it. There's just no publicity. Like, it seems like these should be rock stars and we should be hearing about these events like on the news or something, like, oh, so-and-so scored this, you know, like a recap for any sport. I think if that could happen, then maybe the attitudes towards it by the general public would change, or just to be more interest in general.
Hopefully, on my little journey through all this, hopefully I can show a little bit more about the process. And I think one of the things that is a little, not scary, but put some distance between the competitive guys, and it's just like how inaccessible these events are, just understanding what they are. And I don't know what a great way to say this.
Well, I think I understand. I was reading the listing on flycomps.com for the event you participated in, and I mean, I'm not trying to throw shade, but there were like 5 or 6 major typos, and I didn't really even understand some of what they were saying in the description for the event. Like, well, maybe they could put a little more effort into even just listing the events.
Right now, I know one of the things they are having trouble with is getting enough people to fish these qualifiers, at least on the local level. Yeah. When I was there was a lot of discussion on how we can generate some more interest to get more people involved in these. I was hoping some of the things I could do with my YouTube channel was just to show, like, you know, it's not that intimidating to go fish these things. You just kind of go fish, you can take it as seriously or just use it as an experience or open to everybody. But I was just hoping I could show, you know, it's just a bunch of, you know, nice, cool fly fishing dudes getting together, having a good time, counting the fish they catch.
Well, certainly having some content like that out there helps, and I appreciate you doing your part. I think it's just all about communication. Like, nobody even knows about flycomps.com. I mean, that they can just go there and look and see what's coming up. Just like I said, communicating, explaining what it's about, what the rules are, and it's just a little bit of ad hoc kind of piecemeal vibe right now. Like, it's like people just, it's not all in one place.
And it is honestly kind of like that right now. It's just most of the competitive guys probably feel it too, but there's sort of a stigma to being a competition fly fisherman, so you don't, the way some people feel about euro nymphing, right? They kind of turn their nose up on it, not for them, and they think people that do it are kind of like, don't get the, it's not what fly fishing is about.
They're not purist enough.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the guys are kind of guarded and not necessarily wanting to out themselves as a competition.
That makes sense. So is there also sort of a, maybe on purpose or not, where they kind of want it to be a small scene?
Having a good discussion on how they can generate more interest and more publicity for these. Because they feel like if more people know about it, understand it, kind of get a feel for what these are, they'll kind of lose some of that, you know, stigma that's attached to it, and people will be like, oh, you know what, these are kind of cool. Like, bass fishing tournaments are such a huge thing.
They're huge, right?
You know, most just general, you know, normal bass fishermen look at guys like, you know, Scott Martin, Kevin Van Dam, all those guys, and they don't like turn their nose up on him and say, oh, these crazy comp bass fishermen, they respect the hell out of him. So that's one thing I think Lance and Devin have done a good job of doing, is that they feel like they've kind of at least made comp style fishing a little bit more accessible to people. And I think that's kind of helped get, they're like the first wave of people to help generate some interest into it. I mean, that's what's got me into it, is like seeing the content Lance and Devin put out and hey, that looks pretty cool. I want to try that.
I think in terms of where NeuroNymphing's at now, it's definitely become more mainstream. It's almost like in the beginning you were a knuckle dragger if you NeuroNymphed, and now you're elite if you NeuroNymph, or depending on which circles you're in. But I think a lot of people, at least from my point of view, I fish a mono rig, which is not a comp legal rig. And a lot of people fish a certain way, not realizing that they're, you know, basically working within the competition framework. And that's thanks to people like Lance and Devin. And I think if they knew that, that might bring some more interest to the comp scene in general. Like, I kind of like the freedom of not having to be restricted by the comp rules. But again, I understand why they're there, and working within them is totally respectable if that's what you're trying to do. But I guess my point is just that I think a lot of people don't realize how much influence the comp scene has over at least a lot of the popular NeuroNymphing techniques we're all using. And I think if people realize that, they might be more open-minded about it.
Yeah, definitely. Like, the competition scene has definitely pushed a lot of innovation forward in the fly fishing space. Like you said, the mono rig's pretty much born out of the European style leader system, and then just jig flies, you know, fly tying patterns, stuff like that, are born out of not being able to use split shot and just having to have the flies weighted in a way that will get them down.
I'm all for it. I mean, I think there's no right or wrong way to do things, and I think anytime we can look at things differently and catch more fish, I mean, that's ultimately what we want to do here, is learn how to catch more fish and more often. Maybe you knew more about the history of that. I was told that some of these rules, like no split shot or no indicators, was just born out of trying to make it harder. Like, people were just catching too many fish. Is that kind of how it went down?
I'm not sure where, like, the no indicator thing happened or no split shot. They just fish a little different in Europe, too, which is where most of the comp.
Is the comp scene more developed there in Europe? Because I feel like the United States generally isn't as competitive as some of the European countries. Is that just kind of born out of just how unpopular it is, or just how, not unpopular is the wrong word, but just unknown?
Yeah, and they're kind of like the European teams, or all the top teams generally are from Europe. They have a lot more support within their countries, for sure. You know, funding, getting like the top guys together. And in the US, it's still kind of like a winging it type of thing. There's not a lot of, well, investment from the community into it. Whereas in Europe, like, there's a lot of just national support.
I mean, it's harder to organize over so many different regions. I mean, some of these European countries are the size of a state, so.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the issues that the competition circuit has here in the U.S. is that people have to travel so far to get... It's tough for us to get out to the East Coast just to fish one of these.
Sure.
You know, even within the Western region, that's Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Utah, and...
Yeah, that's like
California.
Everything from the Rockies West.
You might drive 13 hours to get to... That's your one-day qualifier. It's tough to get people out.
Are there environmental reasons? Like, they can't get permitting to host these events? Is that kind of why that they are where they are? Do you know?
I'm not sure what goes into that. I've never organized one of these, so I wouldn't be the guy to ask about.
I imagine there's got to be pushback or whatnot. I have a little experience working with a guy who was trying to set up some trail races that went through various national forests or state parks, etc. And... I mean, every agency that whatever you're doing goes through, you have to get a permit for it. And I imagine that something like a fly fishing competition would have to have, I don't know, like some environmental group sign off saying that the river can handle it or have extreme restrictions. I don't know. It seems, at least in California, that seems tough.
Yeah, and most of these do tend to be kind of in the middle of nowhere for a reason, because unless you can get, I don't know, some specific authorization to shut off a certain section of public water or something like that, you know, you don't want random people walking through.
Right. That makes sense. I hadn't really considered that. That, yeah, it's a public place, so you'd be fishing somewhere that potentially could have another angler just walking through doing whatever they're doing. That's funny.
So I'm not really sure what goes into all of that. Maybe I'll get to the point where I want to organize some of them out here, but it seems like we have Utah guys that like to organize.
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, to take it back to running events, there's just not like this culture where people want to go and I want to run this race and compete, or, you know, there's like a, it's kind of like a, you get these belt buckles, like a rodeo buckle for running ultra marathons. And so people go and collect them. It seems like there should be the same kind of excitement. Well, I want to go compete at the event you just did on the Six Rivers or Six Lakes or the whatever's going on in Bend. Or it seems like there's not that kind of, maybe just because the numbers are so low that, you know, you can't have 100 people sign up for one of these things. You can't quite do that. But you know what I mean? Like to have a, like a, some kind of a prize at the end, or, you know, some kind of swag bag or something. There's just no money in it, it seems like. I mean, the sign-up fee for your event was $100, and that included, you know, lodging. That's like nothing.
Yeah, I mean, and the only reason there was a fee was because we're on a private resort, and they needed to pay our access fees for it. I think a lot of them are not fee-based as well. The team's really in its infancy. Maybe they're moving beyond that a little bit, but the open qualifier thing has only been around for maybe 10 years or so. Before, the national team was just picked by the guy organizing the team knew. So it was only recently that the team started to move towards a more qualifier, let's find the best guys in the country based, you know, model. So there's, I think, still building that, you know, building the enthusiasm and infrastructure for all that stuff.
Well, that's exciting to watch it develop. I am curious. I know I've talked previously in saying I didn't have interest in competing, but I think it'd be fun just to experience it and just to sort of see how, because everybody wants to know, I mean, in their heart of hearts, I think they want to know how they stack up against other people in terms of their angling skill. I know they say they don't, but I think that many people do. I mean, they're at least curious. I mean, I don't necessarily have desires to be the best person on earth, but you just want to know, like, how good am I? How do I compare? And I think it'd be fun to sort of figure that out. Just see how good or bad you are.
Yeah. If there's one in your area, do you think you'd want to try it?
Probably, but I'd
have to shoot one.
I would need a lot of work. Like I said, I have a big hole in myself as lakes. Obviously, I don't have a lot of experience, but even, you know, tight lining inside of the FIPS rules, I don't do that at all. So I would have to definitely get a rig set up and learn how to fish within those guidelines. I mean, I use split shot all the time. I use indicators all the time. And that would be a major adjustment.
I think you'd do all right.
Well, I appreciate your vote of confidence. I don't know. It's interesting since I've started guiding, seeing people and teaching people how to do this. It helps you refine your game, because like you learn how to communicate to these people what to do, and it just sort of helps you refine yourself as well. So I definitely, this last 6 months, feel like even just my tight lining has improved, but I need to get a real Euro rod and try it out. Like I said, I don't even have a Euro rod anymore, like a Euro tapered rod.
Yeah, so one way that might be interesting to get a feel for what comps are like is to see if one of your local comps are using controllers, and then you can sign up and volunteer as a controller.
That's a great idea.
You can watch the op anglers fish.
That'd be fun.
I think it's not confirmed, but there's rumors that Worlds are coming back to the U.S. in a few years. they're always looking for volunteers to be controllers for that. That'd be a great opportunity to watch the best guys in the world. You know, fly fisher are local waters.
That's true. Well, and it'd be fun just to be involved and volunteer, like you said, just to be a part of the community. I think that's a cool way to contribute, because I think it's just like hunting or any other just general sports where you're using a natural resource. To use it, you got to respect it and contribute. So I think I bet a lot of people in the comp scene are big conservationists, or they'll have river cleanup days or participate with Trout Unlimited or whatever. I'm sure that's a big part of the sport. Well, we've been going on for an hour and a half. I got to get up early and go fishing tomorrow morning. So I think this is a good place to put a period on it. I really appreciate you sharing some of the behind the scenes part of the competing and fly fishing. I know a lot of people are curious, and they don't really know where to turn to find answers. So I think this will be interesting to a lot of people. So thank you.
Yeah. Hopefully as I do more of these and have some more insight, we can talk about it a little bit more too.
Definitely. Well, maybe you can get me involved too, and so we can pick your brain about some of these things in a more personal level so I can implement them myself. Cool, man. Well, thanks, everybody. If you want to check out, go to Trout Flies on YouTube. I'll put links down in the description, obviously. Bob sells flies. He has a ton of patterns that he's created and sells. So if you want to get some hand-tied flies that really crush, definitely check out his website. Remind me, it's troutfliesutah.com.
Yep, that's true.
That's the one. So check that out if you want to get some of his stuff. Highly recommend it. Thanks, Bob.
Yep, thanks, Eric. Good talking to you.